Welcome to Between Axles, your not-so-serious car podcast. My name is Peter, I'm your host, and today we're joined by two of my great co-hosts from Melbourne, Jono and Paul. We've got an interesting topic tonight. We are doing brand talk, Nissan. We have our limited experience, but I think you're going to find some of our stories intriguing and entertaining. But thank you so much for joining us tonight. Just getting everyone in the room. Hey, Jono, did you get to much this weekend?
Not too much. Just relaxed a bit. We went out to South Melbourne Market, did a bit of shopping. Yeah, pretty chill.
How about you, Paul? How's your weekend going?
Yeah, not too bad. Just working on the garage at the moment. I'm actually recording from live within my garage, so pretty exciting stuff. Just set up a new welder, welding trolley, and just getting my stuff together, ready to start making new panels for the Z. So it's been a pretty productive day, actually.
Interesting. We'd love to hear more about that work coming up.
Yeah, perfect topic, right?
Absolutely. Because every time I'm thinking, who the hell has Nissan? I'm thinking, oh, that's right. You guys have a Datsun that's not driving in your garage.
Who has a working Nissan? That's definitely not us.
Everyone that's not on this podcast.
People like to make a point of it not running, eh?
I feel like that's a rite of passage to car guys, eh? Buy a really expensive car that doesn't go anywhere but costs twice as much as a normal car they run.
I mean, the whole reason why I chose Nissan is there's a big fan base behind Nissan, right? All the 80s, 90s. Via Skylines, right, to Silvias, to 350Z, there's a big fan base. But another interesting aspect of it, only a recent development, is that they go through so much scandal and so much bad press as a company. It's a mess. It's very hard to understand where they originated from. They had this company, that company. There's nothing really interesting. It's just a lot of companies changing names and changing hands. Through the 20s and 30s, and their first product was like the Datsun. Well, sorry, we should start by what the company name was. It was Datsun, right?
It was called Datsun back
then.
Prince is an interesting one because Prince came in a little later, actually, in the 1960s. So when Prince got bought out by Datsun, they brought in the Gloria name and the Bluebird name and a few other product names.
Oh, right.
But before then, they had they went by DAT, D-A-T, DAT, Jidosa and Co. Limited. But after the founders, so D-A-T was the last names of the founders.
Oh, wow. There you go. Who would have known?
Thank you, Wikipedia.
Technology is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I could probably make the whole podcast using Wikipedias. I guess throughout the 30s, they had some company changes here. And Nissan came by in 1934. And that was also a shortened name of a longer name.
Yeah, I thought it was a combination of one, of DAT, and then another son, I don't know the name, potentially, and they just merged the two together. Oh, sorry, Nis.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. One of my favorite early stories is that they actually work closely with the Austin Motor Company.
The English one?
The English, yeah. So they imported the body, the shell of Austin's, and brought it into Japan. There was a very popular model called the Austin 7, and they brought the shell into Japan and only sold a couple thousand.
I know Japanese were very notorious for copying the European and American, well, actually not even American counterparts, mostly European counterparts, and then just make them cheaper and more affordable.
Everyone learns from a different motor. You know, the Koreans learn from the Japanese, like Mitsubishi, and the Chinese learn from both Korea and Japanese. So,
yeah. Mm. So, I suppose that's just, you know, the same thing over and over again, even in the early stages. Even the Datsun Z was considered a very Jaguar E-type inspired car. Same with the 2000 GT from Toyota.
Yeah. Speaking of Jaguar and the UK heritage, and going back to Austin, the Austin engine, they actually took that and redesigned it to make the first Nissan L engine. which is the granddaddy of the 240Z, what's inside the 240Z, and subsequent Z cars. So it's, you guys, you know, you're talking about an awesome engine sitting in your dad's and in your garage right now, pretty much.
No, no, I think we should probably bin it.
I think so too.
Can you imagine if if they did that in today's day and age, if they shipped British Rovers or whatever and then
rebranded
them as Nissans? How would that go down?
Isn't that what a Lamborghini is? A Lamborghini is basically an Audi V10, right? A Lamborghini Huracan used the same motor as a Audi A10.
Absolutely, yeah. V10, you mean?
V10, yeah, the Audi V out of the, what do you call them?
R8s?
Yeah, the R8s.
Yeah, not surprised. Even on the SUV front, the Lamborghini Urus and the Audi Q8, they share a lot of similarities. I'm sure the engine is very close, just a bit more tuning in the Urus.
We could definitely put a Lamborghini V10 into the stats and then, right? Astronomical. But still, this L series is still pretty reliable, I'd say. It was designed to last for a long, long time.
Mm.
I think we're making it a point to keep the L series motor in the Datsun instead of going for a newer motor, which a lot of people do. But it's part of the charm of the car.
Well, you could put an RB in it.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be the same, right?
It really would, lose a lot of its character. I feel like a lot of the sounds and stuff that come from a car is in the engine.
Yep.
Not just the exhaust, but there's an engine note as well.
Oh, okay.
And they make this crazy, because they're straight cut gears, they sound like a straight cut gearbox, but it's actually driving the motor.
Right.
So as you rev up and down, it just makes this this whirring sound that you just can't get anywhere else. So I feel like a lot of the charm of the L series comes from the actual motor itself.
A lot of companies these days just pipe in their engine noises straight into the cabin.
Oh, yeah.
That's just sad, right? I think that's just terrible.
Going back to a bit of history of Nissan, Jono just said Prince Company. The merger between Nissan and Prince was one of the best things that's happened to Nissan, because that's where the Skyline and Gloria and a few other great names came from.
There's can't say much about those particular cars, but they've all got their own kind of cult following, I feel.
Absolutely. Maybe not the Gloria.
Maybe the later ones.
Yeah.
But really, the earliest of the Nissans were all very kind of unique in their own way. And they all each have their own individual cult following, so a lot of diehard fans.
Soon after their merger, your car is birthed. The 240Z, the 260, and the 280, the first proper sports cars the international market got. I think it's about time we asked the question, the elephant in the room, why did you guys buy it?
Why did we decide to buy a 260Z? That's a very interesting question, actually.
Yeah.
It's more, why wouldn't you buy one?
If you didn't know, these cars are appreciating like no one's business. Like,
it was really just an investment, you know?
Yeah. You could actually legitimately say this car was an investment. It was, it's not as popular. L1's the 2 plus 2 model, so it's a 4-seater, and it's nowhere near as popular or as desired as the 2-seater models. We had to have a slice of the cake, right?
Sure.
So my original experience with a 240Z was actually in Japan when I was traveling around there for a bit, and I did a driving experience around Japan, and you get to choose all sorts of cars. You can choose a Skyline, you can choose Ferraris, you can choose NSX, you can choose BRZ, whatever, and you can fang them around, and you can just blat them around the hills of Japan. In particular, the Hakone region, which is very famous for toge roads. For those people that don't know what toge is, basically a mountain pass, and people would drift or drive around these particular mountain passes in Japan, and a lot of them were quite famous, made famous by anime called Initial D, which everybody... Did you guys follow Initial D in your university years?
Oh, yeah.
We did, but a lot of people also would probably recall Tokyo Drift as well, where they're drifting on the mountain roads. That's the kind of road that you're talking about, right? For those people who don't know. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So I did a driving experience, and I decided to choose Datsun Z, awesome-looking car. It's fantastically proportioned. The motor just sounds amazing. And, I just thought I'd give it a shot. And I fell in love with it as soon as I took the first corner, because there is nothing quite nice sounding compared to an L6. Like, you can have cars with more power, you can have cars with better cornering, you can have cars that are quieter, but this thing is purely driving experience. I don't really know how else to describe it. It's not something that you can measure with numbers. I don't know, Joe, what do you think? When you drove it from when we bought our car and drove it from Tasmania to Melbourne, what did you feel?
Well,
by poisoning, because our rear seals on the trunk lid have just dissolved, and we were consuming carbon monoxide gas from the exhaust. But other than that, what did you think?
Well, objectively speaking, the car isn't exactly a fast car or a well handling car. I mean, it's great, but I definitely feel like it's a driver's car, you know. It's just something that just puts a smile on your face when you drive it.
Yeah, nothing feels cooler than fanging down the road and then hearing your carburetor spitting fuel out both from the intake and out the exhaust.
You guys still bought it over though. You guys still bought it though, so it must have been a really, really good example of a 260.
Yeah,
I caught you there with that question.
Next question, please.
So a bit more personal about these questions. How much did you guys pay?
We paid a rather paltry price of $9,000. Actually,
$9,000 Aussie. Yep.
It was running.
Yep.
It had interior. It had what I thought had very little rust. It was all going. It was all together. We saw it. We actually went through quite a few. I went through quite a few examples until I decided to put my money towards this one. Jono probably remembers this, but we actually went all the way to Adelaide for a weekend trip out to see a 260Z, quote unquote. That was complete. It wasn't complete, was it, Jono?
It was a jigsaw puzzle, really.
It was basically he advertised it as two 260Zs, two plus twos, one that was stripped bare, sandblasted, and ready to have donor parts from the second car, which was apparently me, but it had some accident damage. When we got there, like Johnny said, it was an absolute mess. He was telling us, oh, I've got the dashboard at my mum's place, the gearbox is in the garage, this car over here has got seats, but they're actually from a 240Z. They're the same, but it was just everywhere. And he was asking for what, four and a half thousand.
I guess, you know, in the sum of parts, it was probably worth it, but it wasn't quite what he advertised. It was complete, but just completely in pieces.
If you get that little part in the item description, this particular car was at least working.
Okay.
So we could, it wasn't when I first saw it, but we did have to take it to a mechanic to get it to a running state, because there was no way that we could drive the car onto the ferry to get it to Melbourne. And then we flew over to Tasmania to drive it back to Melbourne. And thankfully, the car made its way.
Very thankfully.
Like carbon monoxide poisoning, wouldn't shift into gear, big spiders all over it, but yeah. Made it into our garage, and then when we tried to drive it out the next day, it wouldn't get into gear anymore. We were very, 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 very lucky to get it to the garage with no issues. We haven't actually started since that day, so it's been, going through just bits of restoration as we go. So hopefully, fingers crossed, when I'm done by then, hopefully soon, we'll be able to just turn the key and it'll start and drive.
I do feel like if we had known about, you know, how many things that were wrong with it. we probably would have been more careful driving it, honestly, on the way to the port and whatever, because it was still like a 100-kilometer trip from when we picked it up to where the port was. And when we got back, when it went through its roadworthy, there was just, the list was so long that I think, Paul, I remember you went to do the roadworthy and the guy just, he felt sorry for you and he didn't charge you for the...
he just gave me the A4 piece of paper and I looked at it and I was like, going, oh yeah, it's not too bad. And he's like, oh, have you looked at the other side of it? And I looked at the other side and it was nearly, there's just twice as long of just stuff I needed to fix. And he's like, yeah, so, this is not... This is a starting list too. So he just threw it at me and I just buried my hands into my face. And to be honest, a lot of what the expense has actually been in the tools that I needed to buy to fix the car. So I've had to buy a welder. I've got an air compressor. I've had to build a workbench. I've got a nice vise. This is all just for bodywork repair though.
Mm.
You can also fabricate tools and stuff like that, because what most people, including me, didn't realize is that there's a lot of parts in these cars that aren't made anymore. So what do you do? You really can't do anything else other than make it yourself. So yeah, a lot of it's been the tools. In terms of the actual stuff I had to buy for the car, probably brakes, brake drums, brake shoes. They're really and the front rotors were really expensive for whatever reason. I feel like it's just because no one has them. No, they're just rare. The parts are just rare. No one buys them. They can afford to mark it up. I don't feel like we've spent that much on the car, to be honest. So
I don't want to know.
I feel like most people should. I mean,
yeah, we should do it.
It kind of like goes back to that whole conversation where you bought a $6,000 car and put $20,000 worth of parts in it. Doesn't make it a $26,000 car, does it?
Of course not.
That's different for the Z. Right. And that was the one thing between me and the Silvia, or the difference between this car and the Silvia, is that I threw, $10,000 at the Silvia, I'd never get any of this back. If I put some time and effort into this car, I could probably get that money back. Really clean examples, they just fetch for silly amounts of money. They were considered great cars, but they still were Japanese back in those days. So they were almost stereotyped as being badly designed, poorly made, etc., etc. So for a car like that now, which has such a cult following, it's pretty crazy to think. I don't think Mr. K, the guy who originally designed the 240, originally tried to sell the 240Z, would imagine such astronomical, have such a huge following for his cars 50 years, 60 years on.
What is your ultimate goal with the 260?
I don't know. It depends what John wants. Me personally, I feel like we just need to restore it. I feel like that's the only thing we could do with it. I would love to slam it and
put guards.
Wide guards and something crazy like that. But this car is probably just too clean for that sort of treatment, I feel. Yep. There's very little that we actually need to do in terms of bodywork and to just cut the guards up so that we can put bolt-on flares onto it. It's too disheartening for me. I don't know. What about you, Donner?
I mean, first of all, let's just get it back on the road. And yeah, then if we are going to do anything to it, I'd like to do things that we can at least reverse.
Yeah. Just the novelty of seeing an older car driving around was already enough. You don't need to put massive guards and huge exhaust on it to make it stand out. We'll see how that goes, though. That tone may change. And
that's what we say now.
What else were you guys looking at that time? Was it just straight 260? Were you looking at Supras? Mark 3s?
Yeah.
Mark 3s.
Mark 3 Supras. That was an adventure in itself, and eventually, obviously, to nothing. But we did go through. We saw a couple of examples on Gumtree, which is the Australian equivalent to Trade Me, and saw a couple of nice Mark 3 Supras. One with like LED the LED dashes and wide bodies and stuff like that. They all had the original 70M GTE. Outside of that, I don't think there was anything else I was hugely interested in, to be honest. After I bought this 260Z, though, I did start looking at a Gen 1 Celica. So, Always another project car, yep.
Okay, let's flip back to the history of Nissan, and we'll probably touch base on a few other cars that we've owned throughout the years. What I want to also talk about is expansion in America, because that's a very interesting story. When the first oil crisis hit, the popularity of Japanese cars, especially Nissan, and there was a model called the Nissan Sunny, they were very fuel efficient compared to the land yachts of the American cars of that generation. But it prompted Nissan and Toyota and Honda to begin manufacturing their cars in the US. By the early 80s,
everyone, Nissan included, was building their cars in the US, such as even now the Altima, Maxima, the Rogue, which is an X-Trail, Pathfinder, and the Leaf. Yeah, so I think that's a, to me, it's a very interesting part of their history, because US is a big market for them. Europe also had another interesting story. Nissan wanted to go into Europe. The way they did it, Luan will love the story, is they did a joint venture with Alfa Romeo.
Really? Oh. And before Renault.
Exactly. They did a collab and they made the Nissan Cherry, or else called the Alfa Romeo Anna, which is a small sedan. It's an interesting joint venture that started the European journey.
So what year was this?
This was in the 1980s.
Yeah, there you go.
Anything in the history of Nissan that really stands out to you?
Me, I think, would have been definitely probably more Skyline base. That's such a huge... That is the cornerstone of Nissan Motorsports, right? It was the original Skyline GTR, or more passionately known as the Hakkasuka. Hakkasuka in Japanese, I think, means box. So it had very, very weird proportions at that time. For me, personally, that was the car that kind of put Nissan Motorsports on the map, and has such a huge cult following since day one, basically. After the Skyline, obviously, came the R30s, R31s, R32s, all the way to the GTR that we know today. That's just a phenomenal car.
Mm.
I would have loved to have driven one around Japan. I don't know, maybe next year, Jono, we'll save up and head over to Hakone and fang around an old Skyline.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm game.
We should do between axles Japan trip.
Yeah, that's it.
Team bonding exercise, you know.
That's right. So if anyone wants to sponsor us, you can just DM me on our Instagram.
If anyone wants to hand their keys, you know, to their hacker, then just let us know.
Yeah. So drifting in particular was a big thing for Nissan, even though they didn't make a car specifically for drifting. It became the platform for all the drifters, because they're known to be very jigsaw-y. So they've recycled a lot of different parts. You can get parts from, if you had a Silvia, you'd have parts that you can take from a Skyline, you can take them from a Sefero, you can take them from Laurels, you can take them from all sorts of different cars.
Yeah.
And mash them up for your own performance upgrades for very cheap. So.
Absolutely.
That, for me, was a very big reason why Nissan was one of my cars I'd like to own, because they were just, parts are just everywhere. They're so readily available, apart from this one, the Z. But that's an outlier and everything.
Well, yeah. Even for the Z, there's a pretty big community for them in Australia. So lots of knowledge, you know, lots of people still have them, which is pretty cool.
But mind you, the Skylines had some really terrible models in their years, because I remember, I think it was the 1980s, the R30 or R31.
Right, that's the coolest.
I think it's the ugliest car, man. It may have been because it was brown and it was an auto stock standard, but that was the first Skyline that I ever saw back in 95. And I was like, what the hell is everyone's obsession with the name Skyline? Obviously, I didn't know about any other, like the GTR, or... It's not a pretty car. It may have been a nice car to drive, but it's definitely not a pretty car. It's very boxy. It's
definitely a pretty car, man.
No!
Jono would fight your tooth and nail to that, Peter.
What? R30 or R31? Because they look very different.
The R31 is definitely my favorite the shape of any Skyline. I love the boxiness of it.
Yeah. I think it's a very acquired taste for me. It's almost like comparing like the RX-8 versus the RX-7. Some people love the RX-8 shape. And a lot of people love the RX-FD shape in particular.
Right.
But then you've got the FC shape, which is the generation before that, and that was made in the 80s and was also very boxy and square. So I feel like, yeah, it's very much an acquired taste. But Jono's got to fight you two for now anyway, Peter. So.
Let's move on to the next terrible Skyline, and that's the, what is the V-Series?
250 GT. Didn't you own one of those?
Yes, and I regret it. It's a great car to drive long distance. It's a great GT car. I have to give you that. It's heavy.
it's definitely not my car enthusiasts go for. What was the mileage on my car? It was about 170,000 Ks, and the engine crapped out on itself.
Oh,
it was a 250 GT, obviously the entry level one. I can't remember exactly what happened, because as soon as there was any slight issue, so when I was revving, there was a lot of rattling and a lot of power loss. Wow. I sold it to a friend, a mechanic friend, who probably hates me now, but he got it for really, really cheap, and he thought he could fix it. A month later, he turns up and says he blew the engine experimenting with how to fix it. So I was like, oh, okay.
I feel like he did it just out of sheer frustration.
Maybe. I don't blame him.
I had a friend once who tried to test the durability of an RB engine. I think it was on its way out anyway, and he tried all sorts of stuff. He revved it, he drained the oil out of it, and he kept his foot planted down, and there was valve bouncing for 5 minutes. He would drain all the coolant out of it so that there'd be no heat dissipation. He put sand in the intake and the whole engine sucked up sand. And he said the thing couldn't die. They ended up not being able to kill it.
Right.
For whatever reason. Maybe your mate got really angry.
Maybe.
Frankensteining the engine.
Hey, Matt, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm really sorry. Obviously, the Skyline story doesn't end there. We have everyone's all-time favorite, R32, 33s, 34. Well, the ugly sister, some people call it the R33s. But I quite like it.
They were definitely the least desirable of the Skylines, I feel.
Yeah.
I don't know why, though. That's the thing. I don't understand. I can understand the 32s because they were kind of very popular in Bathurst. They were basically the cars that caused a big upset in Bathurst in the 90s.
Sure.
And then the 34s were kind of like, they likened it to four wheels with a PlayStation on it.
Right.
Because it was the car that everyone got.
Oh, come on. It's Fast and Furious that Fast really promoted it. Yeah. Paul Walker. Yeah.
Skyline.
At this time, and the history of Nissan, sorry, going back to the original theme here, 1999, we're way into the 90s, and the Asian financial crisis just happened, and Nissan was having a lot of financial issues. So Renault comes into the picture now, and it's the saddest story. It's an alliance that should never have happened, Renault and Nissan.
What happened in that?
This is where Carl Ghosn comes in, and he became the CEO in 2001 of Nissan. It just goes downhill from there. Like, yes, they may have, Ghosn may have saved Nissan financially, but their product range became so stale. And this is when their trouble CVT transmission comes into the picture. So I'm sure a lot of people have their experiences from the 2000 cars, including myself. I bought a Primera, 2003 Primera, and the CVT transmission went out, and there was about 2.5, almost 3K to replace. Oof. And that's a common story. Nissan had a company called Jetco, and they had about 70-something% stake in that company, and Jetco makes CVT transmissions. And to this day, they are crap. So that's why the quality of Nissan just goes down.
I think he's been ejected now, isn't he? And there's a new president of Nissan.
Yeah. So he was arrested for.
I thought he got smuggled out or something, out of Japan.
Yeah, that's a cool story. But before he was smuggled out, he got arrested, and he had a few legal issues for mishandling company funds. And then, yeah, so he obviously got kicked off the board, or he wasn't CEO of Nissan anymore, but he got sneaked out through a music box, you know, those heavy-duty music boxes where the bands put the guitars and the amps.
Really?
And he just, he got put in there, and they smuggled from Japan to Lebanon, where he's based now.
What?
How crazy is that, right?
He's probably got a big fancy house and freaking, in the Cayman Islands somewhere, and now he's being smuggled around inside a music band box.
That's right.
Well, living the high life, I feel. He's living the dream. He'd be working for him. cartels.
A few million dollars in Lebanon will set you for life, right?
Yeah, sure. But then we get left with crappy, shitty CVT transmissions that just keep breaking, so...
Mm, I think they had a few lawsuits as well, which I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Mm. So, that's why a lot of people, especially Americans, tell people to not buy the Maximas and the Ultimas, because they're the most notorious for transmission issues.
Which is a real shame. I hope they don't use the same one in the 400Z. Was I the only one who was excited about the trailer? Did you guys watch the trailer?
I did.
The racing cars?
Yeah.
That was actually really fun to see. And then when I saw the Z at the very end, it's like, oh, wow, it looks really similar to the original S30, right? What they didn't show you was the front end.
Yeah.
The 370Z. The 370Z is a funny one because it went through both the 40th and 50th anniversary.
I feel like they're targeting a very niche market. Did you know that the R35 GTR is now 13 years old?
Well, that's crazy because, you know, within 13 years, we went from the R32 to the 33 to the 34, you know, like within less time, I think. And can you imagine if we had the R32 for like 10 years or 13 years, how outdated it would be? I mean, I just think the market is just not really, doesn't really desire cars like that as much as before, right? Or that, yeah, unfortunately.
Did you not ready for the Skyline?
If you look at the retail price of a stock standard R35 GTR in New Zealand, it's a little bit over 200,000 NZD, right? That's the same price as a very good condition, low mileage R34.
Okay, that's crazy.
What would you rather buy?
Don't know.
Man, I'd get the R34 as an investment, but I feel like, you know, if you were to buy the R34 because it's an R34, you'd probably be disappointed, like, you know, after a while. If you really had to compare the two cars together, I don't know. I mean, I can't really talk because I haven't driven either, but, like, at the end of the day, the R35 is, you know, it's so much more advanced. But, you know, I guess for some people, and for a lot of people, actually, it's, I don't know, something special about the R34, right?
I think it's an attachment to the Fast and Furious. You're suffering from
Fast and Furious.
But if you take all that away, you know, what do you have left?
The 2000s, the transmission issue, Carl Gom, and some really nasty Nissan models.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. Just wanted to quickly say, I think what Mr. Gom really wanted to do was increase the amount of models and just flood the market to save them financially. So they took a lot of variations of different cars. So the Duke had offsprings or related platforms with other ones. If I look at Nissan, New Zealand, and Australia now, there's nothing that I would personally buy. I guess the ultimate conclusion with Brand Talk is that would you, if you were given the opportunity, buy a new version of a car brand that we're talking about? And minus the GTR, I wouldn't. There's nothing on there that I would buy.
I have hopes for the 400Z. I think there's some potential with that, you know.
How much do you think the 400Z will be priced at? Because that's an important factor, right?
That is an important factor. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if they'd want to price it close to the new GR Supra or a little bit less or a little bit more. But yeah, I think that is a critical factor.
So, and saying that, thank you so much to our audience who joined us for podcast episode 4. I want to pat everyone's back because we've made it to episode 4. You know, we're gradually getting better. I went to listen to episode 1 and it was terrible. Like, yeah, but hey, we're doing well. And thank you so much to our audiences who joined in. And thank you, Paul and Jono.
All good.
Join us for episode 5. We'll be talking about classic cars, owning, maintaining, how much does it cost, what's out there in the New Zealand and Australia market. Thank you so much again. Have a great night.